Welcome back to The Jewish Story, a Jewish history podcast for the 21st century. In this show, we'll take a look back at the history of the Jewish people, relying on historical documents, archaeologic artifacts, and linguistic data to paint a picture of the past. Last episode, we explored the early decades of the 16th century across the world. We learned about the dangerous fourth escape route from Spain for conversos, aboard the ships of the conquistadors to the Americas, and we watched the Inquisition follow them to this new land, continuing Jewish and converso persecution there. We surveyed Eastern Europe, where Ashkenazim had steadily been migrating east into Poland, Lithuania, and Russia, and establishing communities there. And we got caught up on the timeline of the Middle East, first reviewing Jewish life under the Mamluks, where Jews lived as dhimmi, and then under the Ottomans. We surveyed the unique Jewish communities in the Ottoman Empire, including the Romaniot and Sfardim, and were introduced to the Jewish physicians to the Sultan. This week, we will turn back to Western Europe and meet a family of conversos who was one of the wealthiest and most powerful in the continent and would go on to fundamentally alter Jewish history forever. The family in question were refugees, having moved from Spain to Portugal in the last years of the 15th century, fleeing the Spanish Inquisition. Their original family name was Benveniste, but after being forcibly converted to Christianity in the Passover raid of 1497, they changed their name to the less Jewish Mendez. The Mendezes made a great public showing of their new religion, and rose to high renown in Portugal after establishing themselves as successful traders. They initially set up a small silver and copper trading operation, competing with rival German traders to sell metals mined from Tyrol, an ore-rich region of Austria. But the Mendezes had two legs up on the Germans. First, given the strong Jewish legacy of long-distance trade going back generations, they had access to a unique network of Asian suppliers, particularly from India. Moreover, as Portuguese conversos, they could use the revolutionarily fast Portuguese ships to transport their goods faster and cheaper than could be achieved by most other kingdoms. The result of all this was that the Mendez family quickly became both well-regarded and wealthy, and in 1512, Francisco Mendez and his Italian partner, Giancarlo Affaitati, opened their first office and trading warehouse in Antwerp, Belgium. Francisco's younger brother, Diogo, was sent over from Portugal to help manage the business, and before long, other Portuguese conversos followed Diogo to join. Very quickly, Affaitati and Mendez's firm expanded their operations, trading not just in precious metals, but also jewels, spices, bills of exchange, porcelain, and any other product that a 16th century European could ask for. The Dutch went absolutely crazy for Mendez and Affaitati's goods, and all of a sudden, life in Belgium seemed to change. Candy and sugar loaves were now affordable for common folk, pastries and tarts became much more delicious, and spices began to be more regularly incorporated into all sorts of dishes. The trading firm was lovingly nicknamed the Portuguese Nation by the Dutch, and the Mendez family became exceptionally wealthy. Before long, the quays of the Tagus and Scheldt canals were packed with large warehouses owned by the firm. As they continued to expand, Mendez began trading in Portugal as well, shipping goods from Antwerp to Lisbon. The Portuguese crown, not having the connections or money to move such massive amounts of product, granted Affaitati and Mendez distribution rights for their goods, effectively giving them an international monopoly on the trade market. This was a win-win, as proceeds from the spice trade made up a quarter of the Portuguese crown's yearly revenue, and having a monopoly meant that Affaitati and Mendez could adjust prices based on demand. Diogo, with his newfound wealth, bought a huge mansion with large formal gardens out front, and maintained a household of 60 living with him, including cousins, aunts, uncles, clerks, secretaries, servants, and cooks. At the age of 40, Francisco, the eldest Mendez brother, found a bride, a beautiful 18-year-old converso named Beatriz de Luna, but whose original family name had been Nassi. The two had a large and classy Catholic wedding in the Lisbon Cathedral in 1528, leaving no one to question their commitment to Christianity. They attended Mass regularly, and when they had their first child, a daughter who they named Brianda, they had her baptized in the Christian tradition. But despite their public appearance as faithful Christians, the Mendezes continued to stay true to their Jewish roots. Francisco and Beatriz had a second secret Jewish wedding, with a ketuvah written in Aramaic, and continued to practice Judaism at home. Francisco's brother Diogo married not long after, incidentally to Beatriz's younger sister, Brianda. Thus, the two brothers married the two sisters. Despite their success, the trading business was not all sunshine and rainbows for a converso, even in the relatively safe Netherlands. The Dutch princes were fickle, at times turning a blind eye to the secret Jewish practices of the conversos, while at others, usually after some bullying by the local friars, would begin to persecute them, confiscating property, making arrests, threatening, and particularly extorting them. And the Mendezes were no exception. In 1532, in the wake of his unceremonious meeting with David Hareuveni and Shlomo Malcho in Regensburg, Emperor Charles V's antenna for Jewish mischief was way up, and seeing how rich and powerful the Mendezes were becoming was making him nervous. So the emperor sent men to search Diogo Mendez's house, hoping to find some Judaica there that would give him reason to confiscate some funds from the firm. The spies sent by the emperor did find some Hebrew books hidden away, and Diogo was arrested. But the emperor had made a critical mistake. While Diogo was being taken into custody, a large shipment of spices was sitting in his firm's warehouse. Having not yet been sold at market, the Portuguese crown had not yet collected their share of the profits, which were desperately needed to finance the emperor's war with the Ottomans. And it was not just Rome that relied on funds from the spice trade. The arrest of Diogo was making King João III of Portugal equally nervous. With some prodding from Diogo's brother Francisco, King João and his wife, who happened to be Emperor Charles's sister, wrote a letter to the emperor, calling Francisco, quote, "the most important, the most considerable, and best-supplied merchant known today, who, in every respect, has always served so satisfactorily that I am most beholden to him, and I have reason to rejoice in bestowing kindness and favors upon him," unquote. After this kind introduction, they asked the emperor to respect Diogo's rights and to launch a proper, impartial investigation into the charges against him. The emperor also began to receive some heat from King Henry VIII of England and his Chancellor of the Exchequer, Thomas Cromwell, whose kingdoms had been similarly hit by the interruption to the spice trade. Ultimately, Charles relented and released Diogo in exchange for a fee of 50,000 gold ducats, approximately $17 million in today's currency. It was after this unceremonious arrest that the Mendezes first began to consider leaving Portugal altogether, beginning to fear for their own safety. But if Diogo's arrest piqued their concern, an offer of marriage solidified it. In 1534, just 6 years after his marriage to Beatriz and at the young age of 46, Francisco Mendez died, leaving half of his estate to his 24-year-old widow and two-thirds of the remainder to their daughter, Brianda. This was not an uncommon practice for conversos at the time. Rabbinic and Gentile law both allowed widows to be the owners of their own dowries and to inherit money from their dead husbands. But King João III hardly waited for his bones to settle before writing to the newly widowed Beatriz, urging her to send her daughter to court to be raised by the queen as her ward and married into the royal family. The offer was backhanded and manipulative. Not only would it be a means of converting the young Brianda to Christianity and stripping her of any remaining Jewish identity, but it would also mean that her portion of the Mendez fortune would fall back into the hands of the crown. Beatriz saw right through the offer and had a feeling that the writing was on the wall for her and her family in Portugal. As it happens, Beatrice's senses were sharp. In May 1536, after some cajoling from King João III and Emperor Charles V, Pope Paul III formally established a Holy Office of the Inquisition in Portugal. The first auto-da-fé took place in 1540, and they would occur regularly from then until the 18th century. Thankfully, Beatriz de Luna Mendez had already begun crafting a brilliant escape route, not just for herself and her family, but for thousands of conversos. The information that we have about this unbelievable escape comes from several sources, including a written instruction manual to conversos traveling the route, written in Spanish and dated to 1544, and a 1553 book written by a converso who made the journey himself, named Samuel Usque. Usque was a converso merchant from Spain who fled the Inquisition, first to Portugal, then England, and then finally to Belgium, where he worked for the Mendez family, who ended up saving him from imprisonment in Ferrara. These documents still exist today because they were confiscated and maintained in the records of the Spanish Inquisition. Beatrice de Luna had essentially used the family's trading routes as a skeleton, co-opting them into routes of escape out of Portugal and through France, the Netherlands, northern Italy, and eventually into the Eastern Ottoman Empire. The result was a long chain of ships, wagons, lodging houses, and mountainous footpaths spanning nearly 3,000 kilometers altogether. Trading partners and allies of the Mendezes became conductors who would shepherd the conversos along their journey and try to protect them from the ever-present threat of discovery. The journey would go something like this. Portuguese conversos who wished to escape would sneak away in the dead of night, hidden under cloaks and carrying only what they could keep on their backs. They would head down to the docks at the mouth of the Tagus River, which were often crawling with police aiming to catch any fleeing conversos, and attempt to board a ship. Being vulnerable, the conversos were often extorted by the ship captains, who would demand a hefty fee for their boarding. Once they successfully made it aboard a ship, they would sail north, up around the coast of Spain and France, and would dock at Antwerp in Belgium, where the local rulers turned a blind eye to the conversos, despite Emperor Charles's wishes. There, the Jews would stay in private lodging houses, and would exchange any remaining valuables they had into bills of exchange that could later be converted into money once they reached the safety of Italy. They were told where to find secret synagogues to pray, but were warned not to risk any public sign of their Judaism for fear of being caught and either deported or killed. From Antwerp, the conversos were stuffed into covered wagons, 20 people to a vehicle, in which they would make the days-long journey east to Cologne, Germany. In Cologne, they would be directed to several inns that were part of the escape network, and which would allow the conversos safe rest. After a night's sleep, the conversos would be handed off to another conductor, who would take them by rented boat up the Rhine River to the cities of Mainz or Basel. They would live, eat, and sleep aboard these boats for the duration of the journey, and were given strict instructions that, quote, under all circumstances, you are to behave like respectable people, avoiding all quarrels and arguments, unquote, in an effort to avoid drawing any unwanted attention. Once they arrived in Mainz, the conversos would stay at the Inn with the Sign of the Fish, where another conductor would provide them wagons for the next leg of the journey, which would take them up along the Swiss lakes and into the hills towards the Alps. When they reached the mountains, they would ditch the wagons in favor of mules and horses, along with handlers who would help guide them along the dangerous mountain passes. This part of the journey was best accomplished in summer, when the ice and snow was less plentiful and the cold less biting, but even so, the road was hard. As Samuel Uski describes, quote, many were dying from helplessness and exposure. Women were widowed when they were about to give birth on those cold and merciless roads, unquote. Finally, the conversos would descend the Alps into the Po Valley in northern Italy. But the danger was not over. Within the early months of the route's operation, the emperor had caught wind of it, though he didn't know the exact route. So, dispatched from his office of Murano Affairs at Antwerp, he sent two of his most enthusiastic officers to set up roadblocks on the descents from the mountain passes to catch any fleeing conversos. Should the traveling parties be caught, they would be dragged from their wagons, called Jewish dogs, accosted, beaten, taken to prison, robbed of all their possessions, and then tortured to reveal the identities of the Christian conductors who helped them. The sentence for any true Christian who aided the conversos was death. Those who managed to make it past this last hurdle would make their way into Ferrara, a city in northern Italy whose duke at the time had offered some respite for conversos, and they would either remain there or settle in another city along the Italian coast. And, ultimately, some would continue on through Dubrovnik and into Sultan Suleiman's Ottoman Empire. In the summer of 1537, just 1 year after the escape route had begun its operation, the Mendez sisters themselves made the harrowing journey. Incredibly, documentation of their voyage survives to this day. That summer, Diogo Mendez chartered a boat upon which Beatriz and her younger sister Brianda would set sail, along with Beatriz's nephews, João and Bernardo Micas, and Diogo's younger brother, Gonzalo, who also worked for the Mendez's trading firm. The ship would set sail from Lisbon and head north around the Iberian coastline to its destination of Bristol in England, avoiding the French coast which was known to be crawling with pirates. The presence of Beatrice's nephews on the boat was key, as it represented an alibi for the journey. Should the ship be stopped by officers, they could claim that they were merely taking the boys to study at the Catholic University of Louvain in Belgium, and taking Gonzalo to meet Diogo in Antwerp. As it happens, the sea voyage was not only a physical escape for the sisters, but was also a metaphorical one. While at sea, the two women re-immersed themselves in Judaism and reverted back to their original Jewish names. Beatrice became Gracia, and Brianda became Reina. After docking in Bristol, the de Luna sisters arrived in London and joined a small community of about 70 conversos there. England had passed a law over a century earlier called De Heretico Comburendo, sentencing any Christians practicing Judaism to death, and so the English conversos had become practiced at faking Christianity while still maintaining their Judaism in secret. They would get married in churches, though only to other conversos. They would light Shabbat candles in secret and whisper the blessings, and they would change their names to Christian ones, but with subtle hidden meanings. For example, the Middle English surname Ames also invokes the Hebrew word for forced convert, Anusim. But by the time the de Lunas arrived in 1537, England had actually become somewhat of a safe haven for conversos. Thomas Cromwell had been appointed chief minister to King Henry VIII, and he was particularly sympathetic to the conversos, having befriended the Mendez family decades prior on a visit to Antwerp. This meeting had begun a productive trading relationship between England and the Mendez firm, which had been beneficial to both the firm and the English crown. As a result of this relationship, King Henry largely ignored the goings-on of English conversos, so long as they were not too flagrant in their Jewish practice. The de Lunas stayed in London several months, after which they took a boat across the sea to Calais, France, and then a coach down to Antwerp. There was also an active converso community there, loosely disguising their Judaism, just like the English Jews. There was Daniel Bomberg, a printer of Hebrew books, who claimed that his work was to support Christian theologians and philosophers, but who was actually a conductor in the escape network. And there was Amatus Lucianus, a converso physician who had studied at Salamanca University before fleeing to Antwerp, where he worked as personal physician to the governor and was also involved in the escape network. In 1539, about a year and a half after their arrival in Antwerp, Brianda finally married Diogo in a proper Christian ceremony at the Cathedral of Our Lady. The following year, they had a daughter named Beatrice, after Brianda's older sister, who was, of course, publicly baptized. In recognition of their service to the crown, Diogo and his family were granted access to a private chapel within their home in which to worship, and evidence from the Inquisition shows that this was actually used as a secret synagogue, where the family would recite Jewish prayers in Spanish. Furthermore, as a sign of respect, the Mendez women, including Brianda and Beatrice, were given access to the convents of the Carmelites, a monastic Christian order. Although they would frequent the convent under the guise of being good Christian women, they were truly using it as a shuttle point at which to meet up with young converso girls in need of protection. Overall, things seemed to be going well. The rescue network was filling its role, rescuing thousands of conversos from the dangers of the Portuguese Inquisition. But in 1540, there was a problem. One of the conductors who led conversos through the Alps, a man named Gaspar Lopez, was caught by interrogators in Milan and ultimately broke, ratting out a large swath of the rescue network to the Inquisition. This was a huge breach in the network, and Diogo knew it. He summoned rescuers to a secret meeting in Antwerp to discuss emergency contingencies. Unfortunately, Diogo became deathly ill just 3 years later and had to draft a will. In an unprecedented move, and in violation of the prenuptial agreement made with his wife, he bequeathed the administration of his estate to Beatrice, his brother's widow, instead of to his own wife, perhaps because he trusted the older sister more. This instantly made 30-year-old Beatrice, who was by now already a wealthy woman and intimately involved in the escape network, the wealthiest woman in Europe. This was not news to the Emperor Charles and his sister Marie, and on Diogo's passing, they seized the opportunity to try to take some of the massive fortune for their own. They asked Beatrice to allow her daughter, Brianda, to marry Francisco of Aragon, the illegitimate son of Charles and technically a member of the royal family. Similar to King João's proposal years earlier, this would instantly bring the girl's inheritance under the crown's control. But Beatrice saw right through the offer, deftly evading Marie's continual requests for a meeting. In a letter that Marie wrote, she says, quote, The mother excuses herself on the pretext of illness, and she might well do it again, unquote. Becoming frustrated, Charles and Marie decided to turn up the heat on the escape network, ramping up the arrest, imprisonment, and torture of new escapees. Beatrice, bold as ever, responded by starting to host escaping conversos in her own household, a giant FU to the emperor and his wife. Tensions could not have been higher, and Beatrice knew it was time to get out of town. Thankfully, she had already started to extricate Mendez's assets out of the Netherlands. She had sent a bunch of inventory to a guarded warehouse in Bavaria, had drawn up a map of outstanding debts that she could collect en route, and had begun to convert various assets into cold hard cash. On top of that, several years earlier, she had started to make annual trips to a spa at Aix-la-Chapelle to set up a pattern so that her final escape would not seem suspicious. In the spring of 1545, it was finally time to go. Beatrice and Brianda set sail south, first to Besançon, and then to Lyon and through the Rhone Valley towards Italy. But it didn't take long before Marie figured out what was going on. This was the last straw. She publicly outed the Mendezes as Jews, declaring Diogo to have been a Judaizer, and demanding the confiscation of all of his assets, including the inheritance he had bequeathed to Beatrice. Both de Luna sisters were summoned to appear before a tribunal, where their fates would be decided. Having arrived safely in Venice, though, the de Luna sisters ended up sending their nephew, João, to Brussels to argue the family's case. João made the argument that his aunts were living as good Christians in Venice, and their only error had been to travel from Antwerp without the proper authorization. After several meetings, Marie finally agreed to drop the case for a settlement of 30,000 ducats, ultimately her need for cash outweighing her pride. But now back to Venice, which at this time was ruled by the Este family, an Italian dynasty who had been very welcoming of Jews. As early as 1493, Duke Ercole I had invited 21 Spanish Jewish families fleeing the Inquisition into Ferrara, granting them full rights of residence and religious practice, rights which were affirmed by Duke Ercole II in 1538. As a result of the Este family's welcoming attitude, many prominent Jews had immigrated to northern Italy, both Ashkenazim and Sephardim. But although things were good for Jews in northern Italy, they were not perfect. Venetian Jews and conversos still mostly lived in one of the two Jewish ghettos, the Ghetto Nuovo, which we learned about earlier this season, and the Ghetto Vecchio, which had been established for Jews coming to Venice from the Ottoman Empire. But the rules were different for the de Lunas, with their magnificent wealth and reputation as good Christians. They were allowed to settle in the swanky Palazzo Gritti, a large brick building on the Grand Canal, outside of the ghetto. Unlike in Spain and Portugal, Venetian Jews were allowed to practice their religion, and so there was a push to reintegrate conversos, many of whom had lost some of their Jewish knowledge, culture, and language back into Jewish culture. Gabriel Enriquez, a converso moyal, circumcised 800 converso men in the Italian city of Ferrara alone. He ultimately became the only moyal in Jewish history to ever be publicly executed, after the Portuguese Inquisition got their hands on him. Also in Ferrara, a Hebrew printing press run by Abraham Uske and Yom Tov Atias published Jewish Siddurim, first in Ladino using Latin characters, which would be easily read by conversos, then in Ladino using Hebrew characters, and finally in Hebrew alone, as a way for conversos to slowly assimilate back into the Jewish community. In 1553, they published the first Ladino Tanakh. But as the 16th century wore on, safe havens for Jews and conversos in Europe were dwindling, as Christian society was changing. Decades earlier, in 1517, a Christian revolutionary named Martin Luther had published 95 theses in opposition to the Catholic Church, which would go on to become the basis for Protestantism. Luther believed that the papacy had become too politically powerful and corrupt, selling off spiritual privileges or exchanging forgiveness of sin for payment. Very much like the split between the Sadducees and Pharisees in Hasmonean Judea, Luther, a pastor and professor at the University of Wittenberg, believed the papacy had drifted from Christianity's roots. He believed that priests should not have the authority to forgive sin, and that Christian beliefs should be dictated not by the Pope, but by Scripture alone. He believed that Jesus was everywhere, and thus rejected the idea of transubstantiation. And, most substantially, he believed that all a Christian had to do to get into heaven was to have faith in Jesus, no matter what your level of Christian practice. For his heretical beliefs, Luther was excommunicated from the Catholic Church in 1521, but within less than 20 years, his movement had gained a serious following, with subsequent Protestant leaders like John Calvin adopting their own brands of Protestantism. This sudden counter-movement within Christianity was known as the Reformation and became a serious concern for the Catholic Church. By the early 1540s, it had gained such prominence that the Catholic Church felt they had to respond. And so, in 1545, the church held a meeting called the Council of Trent in order to formulate its formal response to Protestantism. During this council, they laid out the Nicene Creed, which formalized the central beliefs that all Catholics must hold, including belief in the Holy Trinity, in Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection, and in the Second Coming. It also fixed the canons of the Old and New Testament, declared that Catholics could officially use Latin translations of the Bible for doctrinal proofs, as opposed to relying on the original Hebrew and Greek texts. It reaffirmed the belief in original sin, and affirmed that for Catholics, ascension to heaven was dependent not just on faith, but also on following Catholic ritual practices. Capping off this change in Christianity was the death of Pope Paul III in 1549, a man who had been opposed to Jewish expulsion and the Spanish and Portuguese Inquisitions. He was ultimately replaced by Carafa Pope Paul IV, who took a much harsher tone towards Jews, and who we will hear more about shortly. The rise of Protestantism, the Council of Trent, and the ascension of Paul IV were the beginning of the end of Jewish safety in Central Europe. In the first year of the new pope's reign, conversos were expelled from Belgium, being forced out of their homes without warning in the dead of night, and a new wave of Judaizing trials were launched. It was not long before this tide of anti-Semitism touched the Mendez family. In 1551, still bitter over being denied her fortune, Brianda went to the Venetian authorities, accusing her sister Beatrice of Judaizing. Beatrice returned the accusation, and ultimately both sisters were summoned to appear before Venice's Council of Ten, with police being placed at Beatrice's house to prevent her from escaping. 2 years later, in August of 1553, a council of Italian cardinals ordered all Talmudim to be burned on charges of blasphemy. On the first day of Rosh Hashanah, scores of Jewish books were burned in Rome, and not long afterward, Talmud burnings began occurring in cities across Italy, including Ferrara and Venice. Once again, the Mendezes were no longer safe, and Beatrice, with the help of Moses Hamon, chief physician to the Ottoman Sultan, managed to sneak her daughter out of the city and into Constantinople. But although Beatrice was on the run, she continued to travel in style. According to a Spanish account of her arrival in Constantinople, quote, "A Portuguese lady calling herself Doña Beatrice Mendez, very rich, entered Constantinople with 40 horsemen and 4 triumphal chariots, filled with ladies and serving women. The household she had brought with her was nothing short of that befitting a Duke of Spain. Respects were paid to her at court. While she was still living in Venice, she had already arranged with the Grand Turk that she required no special privileges, except that her household might wear Venetian dress with stomachers and coifs. This she obtained, and would certainly have gotten more had she asked for it." Unquote. Brianda, on the other hand, had her own problems. Her daughter was now 13 years old, and was becoming an increasingly attractive match for Venetian Christian nobles. Fearing the loss of both her daughter and the remainder of her fortune, Brianda hatched a scheme to shield her daughter from the unwanted suitors. She asked her nephew, João, the same one who she had sent to argue the Judaizing case before the emperor's wife years earlier, to profess his love for Beatrice, elope with her, and marry her in a Christian ceremony, and then claim to have consummated the marriage. This would effectively make Beatrice unmarriable by anyone else. The plan was put into action. João picked up Beatrice in a gondola in the dead of night, and eloped with her to the city of Faenza. Unfortunately, when they arrived, they were detained by the authorities and questioned, but the smooth-talking João got them out of trouble and brought them safely to the city of Ravenna, where the two were ultimately married. When Brianda heard of the marriage, she pretended to be horrified and sent word to the Ravenna authorities, begging for her daughter's return. As requested, Beatrice was safely returned to Venice, and Joao was banished from the city. By the mid-1550s, in the midst of auto-de-fés, burning of Jewish books, and expulsion of conversos throughout Europe, the Mendez family seemed to have reached a breaking point, pushing back against the prevailing Jew hatred and re-embracing their Judaism proudly. In 1555, when Brianda and her daughter were once again brought before Venice's Council of Ten on charges of Judaizing, they proudly admitted their true religion and claimed that they wished to go live in the Jewish ghetto as openly practicing Jews. Bernardo, Brianda's nephew and Joao's brother, had settled in Constantinople, had himself circumcised, and changed his name back from Bernardo to Shmuel Nasi. In 1558, Shmuel returned to Ferrara to marry the very girl he had helped his brother elope with, now 18-year-old Beatrice, who herself had reverted to her Jewish name, Gracia. Gracia seemed to take a liking to Shmuel, and the two were married in a fully Jewish ceremony in 1559. Their wedding medallion actually still exists today, with a portrait of Gracia and her name in Hebrew characters engraved upon it. As you can imagine, it was a highly tumultuous world for Jews in the 16th century. Europe was a constant battleground where nowhere was safe for long, but Jews, if they were clever enough, could usually find some sort of safe haven. This idea is well summarized by Portuguese escapee Samuel Usque in his book, Consolation for the Tribulations of Israel. He says, quote, "By scattering you among all peoples, he, God, made it impossible for the world to destroy you. For if one kingdom rises against you in Europe to inflict death upon you, another in Asia allows you to live. If the Spaniards burn you in Spain and banish you, the Lord wills for you to find someone in Italy who welcomes you and lets you live in freedom." Unquote. And that's where we'll end this episode. Next week, we will pick up our story right where we left off and see what was to become of Beatrice de Luna, now calling herself by her original Jewish name, Gracia Nasi. As you will see, she was destined for great things and would go on to influence world politics forever. That's next week on The Jewish Story.